All right, good morning. Today is Wednesday, October 15th, 2008. My name is Allison Page. I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. And this morning I will be interviewing Mr. Robert M. Lulling with his experiences at the U.S. Forest Products Lab. Mr. Lulling, if you want to maybe start, tell us a little bit about your background, where and when you were born, what was your early education and your interest in wood products?
All right. First of all, my wife's grandfather worked for the Forest Products when it was located on University Avenue by the Mechanics Building. And I was dating my wife in high school and got to meet her grandfather and spend quite a bit of time with him. And the war began, and I was going to school at that time, and he suggested that if I were interested, the Forest Products was beginning to hire personnel, and that I may inquire as to whether or not they had an opening for me, because I was thinking in terms of getting married, and I would need outside work. Yeah, well, I finished my education. There were seven couples in our high school that married shortly after they graduated, and in 2000 they all had remained married. And so the most of them had 60 years in the marriage, which I thought was very nice. Well, anyhow, I knew about the national reputation of the laboratory. And it seemed to me like that would be a good place to go. I came to the lab and I inquired as to whether or not they had a position for me. And they said, well, they did, and that they were interested in hiring me. And so I went home, and shortly thereafter I was phoned and told me that I was hired. And that was in June of 1942. But I was told at that time that they couldn't hire me or put me to work until later, when the government okayed the employment. So it wasn't until September that I actually came to the laboratory and started working. I wanted to work in fiscal control because that was part of what my education was. And they they told me that, well, they were in the process of going through a list, and that they couldn't exactly promise me a position in fiscal control, but that I had sufficient laboratory experience that they could put me someplace else, and when an opening existed in fiscal, they would transfer me. Well, when that time came, I was not transferred. Dr. Hunt at that time was our division chief, and he said that I really was too important for him to allow me to go into fisco. And after talking to him a little more, I found out that people that worked in fisco really didn't climb the ladder very quickly, because in order to do so, they usually had to go to a different agency. And I didn't want to leave town. And so that's how I began to work at the lab. I started in WPR, which at that time went the wood preservative research. And I stayed in WPR in the adhesive section for 34 and a half years. I qualified as a technician, but had hopes of completing my education while working so that I would get a degree and then would be able to go into with the professionals. Well, I worked in research, and I continued taking courses at the UW, such as Wood Technology 101 under Dr. Teasdale. I also took a course in report writing. I took a course in understanding personalities, thinking maybe that would been in with supervisory responsibilities. And at the lab at that time had a fellow here that was teaching electronics. And he set up a course here at the laboratory, and so I also had about 8 weeks in electronics. The FPL had its own library, and I was able to get books and articles that were related to the kind of research that I was doing at that time. Dr. Winslow was the FPL director at that time, and Dr. Hunt was the head of the WPR, and he's the fellow that hired me. H.D. Bruce was the gentleman that headed up the adhesive section, and I worked under him. My duties consisted in bonding wood to wood, machine testing adhesive joint strength, and determining the kind of failure, if any, in the adhesive bond, and this was usually in a cohesive or adhesive bond. I worked with different adhesives, and most of the time I was able to determine assembly times, pressures, and curing times that were studied while the specimens were subjected to various environmental conditions in the various humidity rooms that the laboratory had. I don't know whether you're familiar with that or not, but we can control the humidity and the temperature, and the object was to determine the best procedures that resulted in the best adhesive bond. I worked there for quite a while, probably 6 or 8 years, and during that time I also worked under study leaders, project leaders, in other words, study groups. And well, when the war too ended, H.D. Bruce retired and Dr. Blomquist took his place. And the lab at that time was reorganized, and the technologists were each assigned to a project leader. And the project leader assigned work and graded the tech. I was assigned at that time to Herbert Eichner, and I stayed with him for about 25 years. At that time, he was then transferred as project leader in fire research. And so I was then transferred to a different project leader. And the organization at that time had a project leader who had one or two or more techs under him. When I left Herb Eichner, the lab reorganized again. I don't recall just what year that was. However, they had a pool of technologists, and the various project leaders could require a certain or ask for certain employees or technologists to do some work for them. And so it was a little different arrangement. Mm-hmm. You asked about my interest in working with adhesives, and it was quite interesting because there were very many kinds of adhesives at that time. During the war, a lot of different adhesives were developed. Most of them had something to do with casein, animal glues. Epoxy resins didn't come in until a little later. When you work with wood, we got to call the kind of adhesion, it was called a mechanical adhesion, in which the wood fibers, being porous and perhaps split, were able to adhere simply by adhering or putting on, brushing on, spraying on adhesive, and then putting the two substrates together, and under pressure the adhesive would either cure or harden. And this produced a mechanical bond. Now this is important from the standpoint that after the war, the epoxy resins came into being, and they were excellent resins in that they withstood very harsh environmental conditions, and they were very strong. These adhesives were brushed on and also sprayed on, but the substrates that they adhered to were the non-porous type, and so it became necessary to come up with a method of preparing the surfaces so that the epoxy adhesive would be attracted to them. Excuse me, my nose is running. Now, wood surfaces had to be prepared also for bonding. And we had a carpenter shop here, and they had skilled carpenters that were able to provide us with substrates that were very, very smooth and flat, so that there was no gap between substrates when you put them together. So most of the adhesives at that time were not gap-filling type adhesives. They had to have a nice smooth surface. Now when you come to the non-porous substrates, which included various kinds of aluminum, bare aluminum, different clad aluminums, magnesium, titanium, stainless steel, and iron. These all had to be prepared for bonding. The principal adhesive that we used here was epoxy. And by the way, we did not make adhesives. We used adhesives that were already prepared. Mm-hmm. Now, the war brought on various new kinds of adhesives that were developed by chemicals. There was no milk or animal hides or things like that that the wood adhesives were generally made from. So we were working with an entirely new concept. This concept started out in Germany mostly, when our a couple of our people in adhesives took a trip to Germany and were able to determine what was going on over there and brought some of that information back to us. Now Herbert Eichner was a chemical engineer, and I worked with him, as I said, but a very unusual, like I said, I worked with him for several years. 18 of those years, I did not work with wood. It was very unusual being forest products. But our salaries came from a grant from the Armed Forces, the Air Force and the Navy principally. And it was unusual. People often asked us why the laboratory was working with metal, and we became very experienced in that, so much so that we were nationally known for that purpose. One of the main things that was accomplished, like I said, was preparation of surfaces. And we tried all different kinds of preparations, washed with acetone, MEK, various solvents, but they were not very satisfactory. And Herb Eichner came up with a formula of using a sulfuric acid and a sodium dichromate wash, in which the solution was heated 260 degrees, and the various metals then were dipped into that solution and remained there for approximately 10 minutes until the metal surface was etched, and then it was removed and the pieces were either sprayed with epoxy and resins or were brushed on, and various kinds of preparations were then examined. The specimens had to be cut. We made test specimens, and because of the strength of the epoxy, the specimen lap was limited to 1/2 inch. Because if it were an inch, the machines that we had at that time could not fracture the joint. It was too strong. Mm-hmm. So all of our laps were 1/2 inch, and the width was 1 inch. And the machine shop here at the lab cut our specimens for us. This type of adherence to the metal, because it was non-porous, the name was developed for that condition. It was specific adhesion. So we had the mechanical adhesion for porous materials and specific adhesion for non-porous materials. The laboratory, of course, became very popular out in industry because of the success in the type of adhesive bonds that we could produce here at the lab. And when I say type, I'm referring to strength under various conditions. It became known as the FPL etch. And in a lot of handbooks and adhesive periodicals, you'll find that FPL etch.
How do you spell that?
FPL. Yep. Force etch. ETCH. And that one thing was so important that it is being used today throughout the automobile industry, in which they have large vats, and they sometimes put the whole frame of that automobile into that etching material. It's used in aircraft. We did research on bonding, like I say, different kinds of aluminum, and of course aircraft was made with aluminum and magnesium. The early aircraft, when they wanted to attach one substrate to another, they used rivets. Well, by etching the surface to be bonded and applying epoxy resin, and then riveting it to propel it, the rivet actually provided a pressure. And the etching provided a substrate with the type of surface that the epoxy resin adhered to. Later on, the Air Force went into putting a chromate coating, a yellowish chromate coating on the metal after it was etched. This also provided a surface that could be glued with epoxy and withstood the same environmental conditions, and also protected that surface a little more than just what the over unpainted surface could do. The metal-to-metal bonding is used throughout the industries for all kinds of things, and it's still being used today. The space program was interested in providing a strong bond that could withstand tremendous heats and And so they inquired. We did not know at the time what we were actually doing and how it was going to be used. Mm-hmm. But later on, after Sputnik and whatnot, we began to learn that actually the work that we were doing at the lab was instrumental in providing the necessary things that required space flight to be done without the space vehicle falling apart. Some of our work also included working with fiberglass. And fiberglass had to be prepared also. Now, it's considered to be a non-porous material too. And it's impregnated with an adhesive and then pressed and laminated. Actually, its thickness varies, the thicknesses. We found out that it was not necessary to etch the glass, but it was necessary to dull the surface. And once the surface was dulled with sanding mostly, it was successful to drill it with the epoxy resin under various conditions. And we made the specimens that were subjected to various heat and cold conditions over in Timber Mechanics. They had ovens over there that could provide the type of environment that would cool or heat the specimen, and then they were tested in tension in the oven. And of course, you know that fiberglass is subjected to hot temperatures and 1200 degrees coming into our atmosphere. So that was part of the work done here at the laboratory. The laboratory never got very much credit. Still does not have credit. We had people when we would talk to them, one of the first questions they asked us, well, what does the forest products make? Well, the forest products does not make anything. They experiment, they do research with things that are already made, or they produce specimens to test under various conditions in order to accumulate data, which is then put into a reading material, and the industry, engineering most generally, used that data that we provided them. I was responsible in some cases to give information for publication in that handbook, which was mostly data that we obtained in our test program. Okay, I'm on page 4 already. One of the things about bonding in non-porous materials is that it's very, very important that no contamination exists on the surface. And you probably recall that the space vehicle has a problem with tiles, heat tiles that are on mostly on the bottom of the ship, coming off. And while I do not know personally what was wrong with them and why they fell off, but I have a very high suspicion that they became contaminated because whoever worked with them had rubber gloves that picked up some debris of some sort, and it doesn't take any more than the oil in your fingers. Just touch a surface, and that chances are that will not bond. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very important that the surface be protected. It does not seem to make much difference exposing the surface to room where there's dust and whatnot going on. But oil especially is bad for it. As far as my work with Eichner was concerned, having worked with him so much, we knew each other's likes and dislikes and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And he got to depend upon me for a lot of the information that he wrote up in report form. He rarely did any research work with bonding and whatnot. His duties were to take that information, compile it, organize it, and get it ready for publication. So I was instrumental in doing a lot of this work that was published. I was the only technologist that worked with him full time. We did have a couple of fellows that came at one time or another later on, but they were to learn what I was doing, and it's more or less a training situation, and they didn't stay there very long, maybe a year at the most. Mm-hmm. But I was predominantly Herb's man Friday. How I got the information from Herb as to what he wanted done, this was done sometimes orally, but usually in the form of a written data sheet or a rough draft. And in most cases, the texts were not permitted to author publications. And in very rare instances, they could co-author some publications. I never was given that permission, but I did write a lot of reports that were considered library reports, and they were cataloged in the Forest Products Laboratory. Mm-hmm. And people would refer by letter is, you know, for certain things, and that catalog reference was pulled and by letter form was sent back to the Inquirer. But I never authored anything that was published. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that was because I did not have a degree. I had the equivalent degree, but I did not have the sheepskin. And if I was ever called into court, mm-hmm. I could not appear as an expert. So that's why, one of the reasons. Mm-hmm. But the technologists in this laboratory did most of the research work. And some of their subordinates helped, but it was usually the technologists that did most of it. Herb Eichner received a certificate award from the Navy for the work that we did on developing the FPL etch. And I wasn't even recognized. Mm-hmm. But I knew, you know, that, what it was all about. Now, there are many different ways of testing things. In our case, we used a specimen that was usually 1 inch wide and a half inch lap. But we made other things too for other divisions here. And one of them was Seaborg's division. I don't remember what that was called. But anyhow, the STAPAC was developed here at the lab. Now, that is a laminated, impregnated piece of wood. And it was very strong, but brittle, but they wanted to bond it. Well, in pressing and impregnated it, excuse me, it became not as steep. The joint was not very tight. Usually it was slight gaps in it, which did not produce the kind of bond that we were looking for. And so we would prepare that surface by hand sanding it with graphite. And these in industry would not do that because it would be too expensive. Mm-hmm. But I did it in the lab to prepare that surface just to show that it could be bonded. And we did do that, and it was very successful. And the automobile industry used that kind of construction for their molds that they used to form various parts of the automobile, like fenders, or I don't know just what pieces, mm-hmm. but the state pack wood, after being impregnated like that, it was very stable. It didn't change in dimension. Another industry that used it was the Army, that, or the Marines, I should say, really, that was interested in producing a rifle that was easier to aim and shoot. And the problems they had was that the wooden parts of the rifle would change in dimension that much that it would throw off their sight. And so they wanted a more stable material to use for the wood parts of their rifle. And they came to use in STAPAC. And also, you could laminate it and get different types of wood. And most of it was mahogany, but you could bring in some maples and things like that too, hickory. That was kind of interesting. And another thing was skis. During the war, we had patrols that would attack using skis to become mobile, and they had some problems with skis coming apart, the wood lamination coming apart. So we had a whole mess of skis shipped here, and we did some troubleshooting and found out what the problem was. And improved that, and I was able to get a pair of skis for my son. I had to buy the bindings and whatnot, but I kind of resented it after a while, because on New Year's Eve he went down Whitefield and broke his leg.
Oh no!
These were not skis for jumping; they were cross country skis, wide, you know. I went, but. That's one of the bad things about it.
With the skis, do you know where those were being used primarily? Were they used?
The armed forces had a ski mobility troop, and they would have a backpack, carry the rifles, and approach the enemy by skiing there on the snow, mostly on the mountains and whatnot. It was not a very large organization, but that's how they got around. Mm-hmm. I was asked to compare five machines that were made by the industry that was experimenting with non-destructive test. Non-destructive being that you did not have to apply pressure or attention on a bond in order to determine how strong it was, or determine whether or not it was a good bond or a bad bond. So they sent five different models of these machines to the lab. And this was my own project at that time, even though I was working under Eichner.
Mm-hmm.
I was to compare these machines and see which one operated the best. And the machine was a method of applying energy to a transducer. And the transducer was connected to an oscilloscope, which produced a sine wave. And we would get a sine wave of the metal joint, it produced a sine wave not under stress. And then we would also know that particular joint was good to begin with. Then I would make, on purpose, poor joints. Mm-hmm. And I had the darndest time getting a poor joint. I put mm-hmm. oil in it, it would show up good on the oscilloscope.
Mm-hmm.
I put metal filings in it, I put various stuff like that in the joints, and I would get an erotic reading. But after a while, I became more familiar with the sine wave and how to set up the oscilloscope so it would produce consistent readings. And I arrived at a more consistent information from the Fokker machine. And I wrote a report giving the details of my research, and we also had a camera hooked up to the oscilloscope so that we could take pictures of the sine waves. And we submitted that information, and it is the Fokker non-destructive test machine that was in use when I retired from the lab in 77. I don't know whether it was perfected since then or not, but at that time, it was the one machine that a mechanic could take the transducer, place it upon a section of wing, and determine whether or not that joint was considered good or poor or bad. We were that good at reading. And today it's used to determine if something is cracked, where the crack is, and it's a life-saving instrument now. And as far as I know, that is still being used. It's a non-destructive type of determining the bond quality. I was very excited about being able to do that by myself and coming out with something that was useful. Later, still working under Herb Eichner.
Mm-hmm. So this brings us up to around what time period?
Oh, goodness gracious, honey. You're asking me. Let's see. We're talking about probably this time in the 60s.
Okay.
Yeah. HUD approached the lab and asking us to do some research for them too. They were in the process of remodeling some apartments, brick apartments in New York for the minority. And what they decided to do was to cut a wall, a large section of the wall, and make a kitchen on the site, and lift it up into that hole in the wall and slide it in place. And they they needed some information to permit them to do this. And using adhesives was one of the ways that they were interested in. We did work with wood to wood and wood to other types of material, all the way from linoleum to wood to carpeting, all those things that you might find in a home. It worked out pretty well. It was an expensive undertaking, and when these minorities occupied these apartments, of course the brick was replaced and whatnot. No more hole.
Yeah.
But I'm going over time.
Oh no.
They found out that the minorities didn't take care of their home. And so they did not do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
However, there is a firm in Wanakee that does make modular construction, and mostly in the medical field, where they will build in site or in the factory. Modular types of room and deliver them to the site, and it's faster, it's cheaper for them.
Mm-hmm.
Whatnot. At that time, they used a lot of mastic type adhesives. Mastic type adhesives usually are provided in a cartridge form and are applied with a gun. And I got to backtrack a little bit here. On this modular form for HUD, we also did research on studs, metal to wood studs. Metal for the strength that it provided, and wood so that the inside of the home you could nail to or screw to. And they preferred the wood rather than the metal. Today they have equipment that you could use just plain steel studs.
Mm-hmm.
But in this day that I'm talking about with HUD, they wanted wood to show, and so we did research with that, and we used mastic adhesive for that because it was a good gap filling material and it had sufficient strength excuse me to allow them to work with it and build with it.
Mm-hmm.
There was one detriment with mastics. There was various kinds of mastics on the market, and they were not regulated as to the type of material that they were made from. They had one time maybe a MEK, methyl ethyl ketone solvent, or they'd have an acetone solvent, or they have a combination or something. You never knew, but it was a flammable type of solvent. And the base material was a lot of different things. I don't really know exactly what they all contain, but for my research, it was important that we knew the flash point of this material because of the various types of solvents. And so we determined by trial and error the time of, and the amount of heat that was required to produce a flash point for the general kinds of mastic adhesives, not a specific kind. Mastic adhesives are used today, and if you went downstairs at that time was the furnace room. Now it's outside, but underneath is the basement, you might say, and there was a furnace room there. And for HUD, we worked with floor tile, asphalt and rubber floor tiles. So they were having problems with rubber floor tiles. And we did research on rubber types of adhesives to be used on rubber tile, and found out that that was not very successful because a lot of rubber adhesives contain an awful lot of solvents which attack the rubber. And so we were able to let the industry know that, and they came up with another kind of adhesive. I'm not sure just what it was now. But at that time, we actually laid floor tile down in the furnace room, and we chose that place because the floor was awfully dirty. Mm. And we figured, well, if it'll adhere to this, it'll adhere to anything. And it did. It's still there as far as I know.
Really?
I have never gone down there to check it, but I don't know anybody who would take it out of there. Mm-hmm. I think the room is still there because it was used for storage when the threat was on that we may be bombed with a nuclear bomb. They stored a lot of food materials in the buckets, or whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm. and put them in the basement here. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Lots of poor grade southern pine forests are located in New Mexico, and of course good wood was becoming very short supply, and industry was interested in trying to find ways of using up the wood that may not be quality-wise up to their grade. And so we tried at the lab here to improve the quality of the wood by various means. And one of those means was to, in plywood, they made what they call ship patches. Weyerhaeuser actually perfected the method, in which is automatically on the conveyor and go by and stamp out defects. Mm-hmm. The defects were mostly where the branches were cut off, whatnot, and leave a scar. And then it would be made into plywood. And of course, they used resorcinal type glue, which actually was formulated in Germany. Mm-hmm. When I told you about these guys going to Germany, one of the things they found was this resorcinal adhesive, which is called a marine adhesive now, because mm-hmm. it will stand up under wet conditions. And most of your plywood today is made with resorcinal adhesive. And these defects were cut out and the patch put in, and this was all done automatically in a conveyor. Well, with the southern pine, the branches are very small, and you can't make plywood out of it. It's very expensive to do so if you try. So what we came up with was a method of removing the damaged area and filling it with a foamed type of adhesive. And this was very easy to do. However, there was a problem involved in that the foam was difficult to determine how high it was going to be above the substrate surface, and it it sometimes foamed greater than you wanted it to, and sometimes it didn't foam enough and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Well, what we did, we determined that we could provide a certain density of that foam by restricting it. We would put just a sufficient amount of foam in there and put a flat metal piece over that area and restrict that foam from coming outside of the void. And that would give it a certain density. Well, we did a lot of that work to determine the density and determine what kind of a surface we needed to use, so that every time we wanted to patch a material, we could put so much of this foam material in there and put the restrictor plate over it, and foam would harden, and it would be of the density that was close to the wood density, and we could overlay it with a fiberized type of covering, mostly pregnant paper. Chet Ressler was the project leader for that particular project, and I was working for him at that time. And Chet, before we finished the project, passed away. And so it became my responsibility then at that time to finish the project. And Leonard Selbo became my project leader. And he really didn't do much other than that. I just reported to him occasionally. And so I carried out the project for its entirety and put the research part of the studies out on the test fence in Middleton. We had an area out there in which there was a fence that the paint lab put panels out there that were either painted or stained, and they were able to get the climatic, the various climatic conditions that way. We had test specimens too that we put out there, and one of them was the panels off this foamed, overlaid foam, the panel. I put some out there that were kind of raw state, we called it. Some of them I painted over the overlay, and they were in very good condition. About 10 years ago, I was out there and checked them, and they were still very good. So, but the ones that didn't have paint on it were bad. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Most of that material at that time was used principally how should I say it? Ressler, when he was alive, went down to New Mexico, and they set up a laminated system. And but it was kind of expensive to produce this product. It was made from mill material, or mill material was made from it, I should say. And that they made quarter rounds and things like that to go around the floors or up wherever they need mill. And later, one of the get-togethers for the retirees, I talked to one of the leaders here at the lab, and he informed me that Anderson Windows was interested in doing that. I don't know whether they ever did it or not, but I doubt it. Now, I come to one of my favorite in my last project, and this was in the 70s. And this, Brian Rivers was the project leader, and project was to determine the amount of movement in an adhesive joint while a dead load was applied constantly and under different climatic conditions. And we were measuring movement in a metal-to-metal joint. That movement was minute. And in order to measure that, we needed a machine that was not available, was not on the market. And so we went to Rowley, I believe it was, in Rock Island, Illinois. I don't know if that's the right name or not. And they said they could make a machine under Brian Rivers, conditions, I guess, mostly. Or specifications is the best way to put it. Under his specifications, that would measure in metric terms joints that moved what we would say in thousandths of an inch. Very, very minute. And they produced a machine that they said could do that. It was my job then to set up the method of testing, and it meant that I would have to wire the small transducer that was in the testing stage, and that wiring then went from the transducer to the machine. We had bugs, all kinds of problems. And since that, how do I say that? That area was in downstairs here. It was in a room all by itself, nothing in it but that machine and the setup for testing. And the first problem we found out was that we had to control the temperature and the humidity in that room. Of course, it took a while to come up with that, but we had to put in a control method into the electric wall plugs and whatnot, and humidifier, we made some tests and didn't get the right answers. And of course, it was my responsibility to go in and use this machine to make the test. Then I had to know what to expect. And I wasn't too sharp on my metric systems, so I had to learn how to do that. And it took a little while before I got the confidence myself, and I'd have to rely on Brian to come in and say, well, am I right here or am I wrong? Well, no, he says the machine is not working right. You're right. You're right. There's something wrong with that machine. Yeah, well, of course, we were thinking about the room. Well, holy Moses, we found out that at night, we would turn the light off, of course, when we left the room. Well, that changed the temperature enough so that machine picked up the difference. You see how? So we solved that by leaving the light on all the time. Well, then we found out that when the janitor saw the light on, he'd open the door and turn it off. Well, we had not only that, but he opened the door, which we didn't want to, you know. And so we had to put a lock on the room, and that wasn't too good, because fire problems, whatnot. The lab personnel wasn't too happy about it, but they could see their problems. That machine was so sensitive. And we still were getting erratic readings. And finally we decided, well, it had to be something wrong with the machine. So we called the people that built it. And they sent two men here, and they took the machine apart, or part of it, and they came up with the idea that the potentiometer that was they were using was effective. So they called the place that they purchased their potentiometers from and told them to send them two brand new potentiometers by air so they'd have it the next morning. And we found out these guys were getting paid $100 a day just to come here and look at that thing. So anyhow, it was an expensive deal. And they came and or the potentiometers came and they installed one potentiometer. And I tried using the machine and I said, I don't know, but that's not the answer. So they went over to the darn machine again a whole day. And they said, finally at about 5 o'clock at night, they came up with the idea, well, that something isn't right and it's gotta be that potentiometer. So I said, well, maybe the potentiometer is defective. Oh, no, it can't be defective. They have this new one right out of the box. The next morning, they checked it, and it wasn't right. The potentiometer was poor.
Oh.
You know, they put the second one in, and that was all right.
Mm-hmm.
But after we got the machine working right, then they box it was on top of it that controlled the temperature of the going into the specimen. That wasn't working right. So we sent it back to the company and they had it for several months. And they sent it back to us and they said, well, they couldn't find anything wrong. They put it in an oven and then they checked the parts to see that the temperature was where it was supposed to be in the box and that area was constant. And they said it worked fine for them. So they sent the box back and we installed it on the machine. Still got erratic results. And I then took that box myself and drove down to Rock Island and told them what was happening. Or what was not happening. And while I was there, while we had conversations with one of the main men there, and he was questioning, being this was a prototype machine, whether or not it would be to their advantage to make another one. Was there a demand of any sort out in the industry for this kind of a test machine? And so I had quite a discussion with them. And I said, well, there's a lot of labs now that didn't exist at the time that we started doing research along these lines of non-destructive testing and testing with very slight movements. And that these, out in industry, they were beginning to make their own labs that would be able to do the tests. And maybe they would be interested in, and the thing to do was to contact some of these companies and tell them what the lab has got and what they could have. But I said, you better wait until we get this one to work. And they sent the box back and they didn't provide anything either that helped us. I don't know what they did to the box, but it didn't work. And there was a fellow by the name of Paul Evans that was a fellow that taught us electronics here at the lab. And he used to work, he used to be in the submarine during the war. And he was in the radio room in the submarine. And he knew a lot about vacuum tubes and stuff, but transducers were kind of new to him. And so he never was too anxious to work with transducers. But he after talking to him, he said, well, let me take a look at it. So he looked at it and he came up with an idea. He got one of these little bit of fans that worked with the battery. It wasn't hooked up to the electric source that we had in the room. And that little battery kept that box constant temperature. That little fan battery kept the box at a constant temperature. That's all it took. And the machine is still down, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
I retired in 77, and a fellow that replaced me redesigned the room, he and Brian did, and finished that project pretty much. But I think stuff's still there, as far as I know. So that takes care of the work. On that machine, I wired the transducers to the machine, and then I took the initial measurements and all that, and then I had to operate the machine, and was instrumental in saying it wasn't working the way it should. That's as important as and finally got it to work. Things that I did, trips and so forth that I made, I was, of course, a technician, and we weren't always permitted to go on trips, or weren't schooled enough, let's put it that way, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But we had the experience, and we actually did the research. And problem, a lot of cases, we know more than a project leader. But I went, first of all, to Nicolet National Forest up north in Wisconsin. And we made a trip up there to observe rubber cutting and whatnot. That the Indians owned our mill up there, and it's on the reservation. And we looked at the kind of work they did, and we found out that one of their biggest problems was they could not count on their help to show up. They were going to do a job this day, and so-and-so was to come, and he was out fishing or hunting or something and didn't show up, and they had that existed. Mm-hmm. Whether it still does, I don't know, but at that time it did.
Mm-hmm.
We went to Wausau Homes up in Wausau, and they were having a racking problem that they used adhesives quite extensively in their building, but when they loaded them on the trailer to be delivered to site, the things would rack from vibration and whatnot, and so they in some cases couldn't even get them off in the truck without them coming apart. We found out that they needed to have a little more quality control, and I guess that solved the problem.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing with Wick's Home out here in Middleton. They built inside. They called it inside, but what their problem was, they oftentimes opened the garage doors or the doors to the room in which they were making construction. And this permitted a lot of, a lot of humidity in that room, which was sufficient to give them a poor bond. That the lumber was stored in there and it took on humidity and remained in there because it was in a garage which was cool. It wasn't heated all the time. So that they just a matter of semantics to get them to be a little more cautious.
Mm-hmm.
But this, you know, that solved a lot of the problems, and that meant money to them, and we saved them a lot of money. One of the things that is kind of interesting, on television, I don't know whether you recall, I've ever seen an advertisement where they have a springboard out over a pool, and they advertising Elmer's glue, and this guy would spring off of the board, and they'd have the board glued together like this, you know, and it worked fine, whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what they didn't know is that Elmer's glue is not resistant to moisture, and this being right over a pool. And while it remained a good bond, it was not for a very long time because Elmer's glue swells when moisture is around it. And when it swells, it becomes weaker. And so if you tried to jump with that board, say in 24 hours after it's put together, it would come apart. It would have no spring to it at all. We also made a trip up to Wisconsin Rapids and a motel there, the Mead Motel, I guess it's called. They constructed a pool and they used the laminated timbers for the roofing over the pool, and they deteriorated. The Groupons and same thing. They used a urea type adhesive to bond those timbers, and of course the contractors that did the work apparently did not know much about grues. Grues would just grow, you know. Mm-hmm. So they had quite a problem. They had to take that all down and use resourceful type adhesives to solve that problem. I went to Purdue University with Brian for a seminar. Brian was to give a talk, and he became ill and had to come back here. I stayed there, but we skipped his speech, and I didn't have to give it for him. But it was an interesting seminar. And let's see, I told you about going down to Rock Island with the machine parts. We went to Chicago. This was early on, and Brian and his wife and me and my wife thought we'd drive down to Chicago to attend a seminar at Drake Hotel. And we took the wives along so they could do their shopping on that
Michigan Avenue,
yeah. And Clock Tower, I was trying to think of it. We went to the seminar and we had a nice meal provided for us and whatnot. And it was underwritten by industry. And we got back home. And of course, our per diem at that time was only $16 a day. Well, we expected to pay for our wives. But we didn't think we had to reimburse the lab for the meal. But we did. They charged us for that meal because it was a gift to us, you might say. And that was taken off of our per diem. Well, by the time you paid a hotel bill, the per diem didn't near cover the cost.
Mm-hmm.
And so we didn't actually put in a claim, but we let the boys upstairs know that we weren't too happy about being charged for that meal. Well, as a result of that, plus some other fellows that were not too happy, when you go to New York, it even costs more. And yet, no, the lab was operating on a per diem. And you got to the point where nobody wanted to take trips anymore because it cost them out of their pocket. So finally, they chose several cities in the United States where they increased the per diem to where someone wouldn't have to pay out of their own pocket.
Mm-hmm.
But that changed in a hurry. Social. The lab started the news pamphlet that came to us monthly. Mm-hmm. It was called The Chips. CHIPS. And everyone really enjoyed reading it because it was produced by the employees. And the director usually had a column or two. And it was very informative. And we had write-ups of vacations and things like that. One happened. It was very, very informative. And we had over 600 people at the lab that time. And they slowly began to downsize. And unfortunately, when they started downsizing, which was in the 70s, early 70s, things begin to happen that didn't happen before. The secretaries couldn't leave their purses on the desk. They had to lock them up. Brian had a beautiful hand-carved picture stolen off the wall. Things like that. I know, Mr.
Really?
Yeah. Hmm. So it the morale started going down. And actually, you could see it. Now, you know, the lab wasn't like it used to be, because we had parties. We were a party bunch. And we would go on charter bus. A whole bunch of us would go to the, at that time, was the Braves baseball team in Milwaukee. And we make a big day out of it, go out and have fun, dinner and whatnot, and take our wives sometimes. And it just made a big thing out of it. And Super Easy had her father-in-law had the bar down here at the corner. And he would come along too and provide the longevity. But we made quite a few football games. We went to football games like in Illinois, Northwestern, Wisconsin games. We were, for a long time, we could get faculty tickets, which at that time were $18 a book. Mm-hmm. And we could buy two books, one for my wife and one for myself. And we had good seating. We didn't always have winning football teams, but we got the tickets quite mm-hmm. reasonable. And of course, you're paying, what, 46 bucks for them now. Mm-hmm. And they took that away from us after a while. But we used the facilities at the university quite a bit. There was a computer there, a 1620 computer, which is an old big outfit. You had to punch a card and whatnot, all the data. You can imagine how many punches I made in all those years. But the university finally got a 750 or a better computer that actually would make graphs and that for us. And but we had to go there to use it. Mm-hmm. It was quite a while before we got one here. But the lab was always suffering for money. And they never seemed to have enough. I played on the basketball team we had here.
Yeah.
We had a slow pitch league in the city, and we had a team for slow pitch. We had a bowling team. We started bowling in one place and then changed when it got so popular we had to have more alleys.
Mm-hmm.
This was men only, but then later the girls started their own league. And, then I suppose it was a little later than that, I guess the co mm-hmm. got together. Golf, we had golf outings, and we used to play at Pleasant View in Middleton weekly. Every Friday we'd take the afternoon off and play golf. And then once a year, or once a month, we went to another course, like Cambridge, for instance, Lake Ripley. And they had a clubhouse there that we could get a big meal. So we always had a dinner afterwards mm-hmm. and made a big day out of it. Maple Bluff we got, so one of our members blocked along the Blackhawks, so we got there, and mm-hmm. that sort of thing. So once a month we went out, celebrated, but we always played golf during the season every mm-hmm. Friday. Two horseshoe courts in the back here mm-hmm. by the building two. Beside, or I guess there was a garage there at that time, and then they moved the garage over. But alongside the original garage, we had two horseshoe courts. And at noon, we used to play horseshoe. And of course, there were a group of us that got to be pretty good, so mm-hmm. we were kind of limited to our one bunch.
mm-hmm.
I actually got the elbow, I got a catch in my elbow, and I had a tennis elbow. And I had to get cortisone shots because I was going to go out to the state of, I was in Washington, and we went up into the forest. And they had years ago hired
one of the forest companies out there, I forget which one now, Weyerhaeuser, I believe it was, because we were up in the Weyerhaeuser forest, to cut a bolt, a 5 foot long bolt, Western red cedar, and send it back to the lab, and then they would cut it up into small test pieces mm-hmm. in order to determine the strength of wood in various areas. Well, the Weyerhaeuser men got kind of, they got lazy, and they took everything out of one plot. So we didn't get an overall picture of what. Mm-hmm. So they sent to me and Arne Hogan out to Washington and another two guys down in Oregon. And we used a random method of determining where to go and where in that area was a tree that we were, a specific tree to cut down, and then within that tree a specific area or location in the tree to cut the 5 foot bolt. Mm-hmm. Well, then we had to get it up. Usually they're down along the riverside, so you're climbing hills and whatnot and over dead timber and what, and sometimes we had to hire guys from the city come out and throw a wrench the bolt up, and then we'd mm-hmm. send it by bus or train or whatever it was back to the lab. That way they got a more precise overall view of what the Western Red Cedar was. Another thing we did only once, but it was such mm-hmm. a feature that they want us to repeat it, but we never did. Mm-hmm. And then we put on a minstrel show.
Oh,
all
really?
The men. And this was for the Forest Service research group that was visiting the lab. And
so what time period are we talking about?
Oh, God. Late 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Gordy Logan was our personnel director at that time. And we had a fellow named Frank. He was head of the paint district. He and Logan got together and they put out a Amos and Andy deal, you know. Oh, it was good. But we had a tap dancer. And I was in a dance band. I had my own dance band from 1950 to 1960. We played around Madison area. And one of the things that occurred with that, I was a drummer. And I was a good drummer, and I was professional, and I had taken lessons under Ronald Leland, who was a top drummer at that time, actually played big time with the big bands. And I could read drum music, and consequently I was on call quite a bit from other bands that needed somebody that could read music.
Mm-hmm.
And because I could get off during the day, take annual leave. When the politicians came in town, we'd have parades around the square. And I get called to play field drum in the parade. And I had to go up to Gordy Logan and get permission to do that because I couldn't represent the lab for a political party.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed funny, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they were very different in those days.
You play for any really famous politicians?
For what?
Did you play at any of the square things for famous politicians?
Well, these were all for famous politicians. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I played for, who were they all? Can't even remember now. We used to go out to the university there, what was that building there by Babcock Hall? I can't think of it right now. It was a horse barn at one time.
Oh, the dairy barn or
no.
Stock Pavilion?
Stock Pavilion, yeah. We'd play in there for, that's usually where the politicians would have their big mm-hmm. talk. And I'd get called to play in there. It would be more like a dance band, no.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So a little bit more about this minstrel show. Where was that? And
on the fifth floor.
Okay.
We had a piano. I played the drums. We had a guitar. Guitar. violin. We had a nice little band.
Mm-hmm.
And John Black worked in adhesives in a different, on a different floor, mostly with adhesives. He was Paul Bunyan with a big beard and whatnot, and he sang 16 ton, you know. And well, he gave a talk. Well, we set it up. I had a little wastebasket beside my drum with a plate of glass on it. And he made maybe if he was chewing gum or something, or tobacco, I guess it was. He spit out towards the windows. Then I dropped the rock on the plate of glass. And, you know, everybody got a kick out of that. But we had an older guy that was on the ground crew that was quite a dancer. And he was in his 60s then. And he could re-tap. And we had the lineup of fellows and the two in guys, mm-hmm. you know, and then they sang songs and they told jokes. And God, I can't remember. I got photographs of it at home.
Oh, really?
Yeah. All love black bass, you know?
Yeah.
And the handkerchiefs and the overhauls and that sort of thing. Yeah, but they did a wonderful job.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's why we got lots of offers to do it again, but we didn't. Of course, there was no women, there was all men.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the women had their own organization. And they had a name for it. I'm forgetting what it was now.
Four Steps?
Yeah, Four Steps.
Yep.
They're still going?
As far as I've heard, yes.
Well, these were gals that worked at the lab, and then they were spouses of the guys that worked at the lab, and retirees, women. And they had their little monthly things and that. And they did a lot of volunteer work. And the men did too. I drove for the Red Cross with blood pickups, and one of the guys that worked here, can't think of his name right now, I don't know how many gallons of blood he donated. Mm-hmm. They won't take blood from him anymore. He reached that age. And I'm 56 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't look at it old, but I am, and I'm in fairly good health. So, I did have a myocardial infarction while I worked here, and one of the things that was in my favor was the lab had arrangements with the university for using their workout stuff in the natatorium. And so I could go down there and take some annual leave and work out. And that was very helpful for me. Mm-hmm. Didn't cost me anything.
Mm-hmm.
That was good. We had card parties up on fifth floor for men and women. We played mm-hmm. euchre and shops golf and I don't know 500 and cribbage boys. Cribbage guys had their own party. They
mm-hmm.
and they gave prizes for that.
I've heard a little bit about the broad fries or
oh yeah steak fries
yeah
man out in Middleton yeah mm-hmm. we had a lot of parties. We did have some guys here. Jim Grady worked in the supply room down on the first floor there. It's changed now, I guess, but. He was an outstanding bowler, was a city champion in bowling, at least for 1 year, I know of. We had a fellow that was our welder that was a champion horseshoe pitcher for City of Madison. We had a girl runner here too, I forget her name. You know. But we had some well-known people working here at the lab. During the war.
Mm-hmm.
Then you start downsizing, and a lot of those guys are gone. We had our own credit union, and I think that started in the late 40s.
Was that located here?
Fifth floor.
Oh, okay.
The office up there. Les Flater was head of it for several years. Uh-huh. Okay, well, one thing about the lab, It's the only forest products laboratory in the world. And it provides all of the services at one time. We could prepare whatever we needed, because we had the carpenter shop that was, well gosh, there were 7 or 8 carpenters in there. They could build anything. Display things that went to Mitchell McCormick place in Chicago and other places too, but mostly there. We had an electric shop that not only supplied things for research, but also did all the electrical work for the lab itself, maintenance. We had a machine shop that made lots of prototype tools and things like that that were needed to conduct research. And of course, they also made whatever was necessary for the lab. We had a tin shop that made a lot of things for research and the lab. We had a welding shop that did whatever needed to be welded and whatnot. We had trucks. During the war, we had actually 3 ships. And when I first started working here, it was a 5-day week. And then after the war was on for a little while, I went to 5.5-day week. And then a little later, we went to a 6-day week. We had to work Saturdays, all day Saturday. No additional pay. We were on annual salaries, and that's the way it stayed. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to take a holiday off, it was mandatory that you took annual leave the day before and the day after that holiday. So there was 3 days. Mm-hmm. So nobody actually took the holiday off.
Was that mostly during the war then?
Yeah, okay. During the war, yeah. Mm-hmm. All salaries were frozen. All promotions were frozen. It was tough when you saw guys like my downstairs neighbor at that time, worked at Badge Ardents. Man, he was bringing home a bundle of money. He was a steam fitter. Mm-hmm. And people were making money, and we didn't. And my wife, when I agreed to come here as a technician, I started out on the bottom rung, you might say, pay-wise. Well, my wife's grandfather told us it was a good place to work because you climbed the ladder pretty good. Uh-huh. We had to live for 5 years with no more pay than what I earned when I came here. Mm-hmm. And of course, I had hoped to work in Fisco, but worked as a technician instead, and the technicians weren't getting too much money in those days. So that was kind of hard during the war. My wife used to get at me. Well, I worked with the dance band, and that's how I actually supported my family. I had one son pretty soon after we married, and we had another son 7 years apart. I had 3 boys, all 7 years apart. I, as in a dance band and being a leader of the band, I got paid double. Mm-hmm. And so that helped us through the war. But this was no place to work if you wanted to get rich. So that was kind of bad. I went through all kinds of directors from the lab. I can't remember all their mm-hmm. names, but at least 6 or 7 directors. And Fleischer was perhaps the director that I was closest to. Mm-hmm. He worked down in what we call the veneer mill in the early days. And we used to go down there and to get veneer and help them out sometimes and shift around. And he became director back in the 70s. 1974, I was given a small cash award for performing duties beyond my grade that I was, my grade mm-hmm. level. I was at the end of my grade. It'll be this 10th step. And they had a rule here that you couldn't go beyond GS-9. The technician couldn't. Well, I was a GS-9 at the end of the grade, so I made the same money as GS-10 or in the professional. I always received a very satisfactory grade evaluation. And sometimes I was, or several times, I was told that some of my peers received promotions because they were older and closer to retirement. So they were favored. And that kind of hurt my feelings too. Because I know two of the guys didn't always receive good grades.
Did that change?
I don't know. It was that way when I retired. That's one of the reasons I retired. And so, Soper, Vern Soper, also worked with the Jesus. He and I retired at the same time. Now, he was a little older than I was. But he was our first aid man. And we provided first aid to the lab and to our visitors. He had several occasions where he was called upon to take care of a heart attack for somebody visiting the lab. We had guys that cut their fingers and sawing things like that. If you didn't feel good, you could always go and get an aspirin from Vern Soper. He and I were pretty close. The lab was not too quick to give promotions. I think we had one or two instances that I can recall where a person was promoted a year apart. But most of us had to wait till we were up to the end of our grade before we got promotions. But I started out in the low long, and I ended up to a point where I couldn't help myself anymore. And we went to the computer, and we had Soper right in, and plugged in some numbers and come out with the fact that if we continued to work beyond grade 10, or the, not grade 10, but the step 10, we would be working for approximately $1.25 an hour.
Oh, wow.
And we could go outside and earn more than that. There were some guys, Ed Moraz was one, who was in the paint department. He stayed, and he got, at that time, the lab had a personnel audit. And as a result of that personnel audit, a lot of us received a higher grade because the lab was not giving us what we earned. And Ed Moraz got a 10, I know. I didn't get a 10 because I was planning on retiring. And they knew it. And it's all right, you know. But Ed only made a buck and a quarter an hour. He volunteered his services when he reached the 10. He decided, that, of course, that was wherever his wage was, it was one step above that. And he actually worked as a volunteer for about a year, and then he decided to complete his time here. He's quite a guy here. But I received this this award, and the thing that I remember, Herb Fleischer apologized to me in front of the people. He said he was sorry he could not give me a larger cash award because the appropriations didn't permit it. Because you can see how close the lab was to, you know, paying off their bills and trying to give bonuses to or rewards to their workers. It was not a nice place from that standpoint. One of the things I think that that the lab was held back because the appropriations were always a fight and always very low. We were in the forestry department, but under the Department of Agriculture. Mm-hmm. And that Department of Agriculture was very large. And the Forest Service was on the low end of the totem pole. Mm-hmm. So we always got kind of cast off what was left. Mm-hmm. And that's why our appropriations were never very large. And our reputation didn't follow our senators around. Mm-hmm. Because we were the only alone agency. The other agencies, there were nine of us all total, the other agents throughout the states had senators that would get perks for them. Mm-hmm. We didn't. Never had a senator that could go to bat for us. Mm-hmm. We had our directors. Al Hall spent most of his time in Washington, D.C., fighting for the forest products. And that was not right. So I kind of made up my mind that the only way the Forest Products Laboratory is going to get in a position where they receive the reputation that they have out in the industry and worldwide, and they can continue to do the kind of research that we were doing at one time, we're going to have to leave the Department of Agriculture somehow, because these guys now, they're still fighting. We had our retirees dinner here not too long ago, and your director here today, I can't remember her name, he told us right out that they've gotten down to 160 some employees and are having a problem, mm-hmm. even with that small crew of getting money. Mm-hmm. So it still exists, and that's too bad, because this outfit here has got a bigger reputation in Europe than they have in the United States. And we're not getting, you know, paid for it. So, mm-hmm. but that's all I have. Yeah, I'm going way beyond my hour or whatever it was.
Let me just.
But.